Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Well, for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the honeymoon is well and truly over. United are back down to earth from a super space flight, and I think the jet lag is really starting to drag. You know it's bad when even David De Gea is making mistakes. And much as Lionel Messi is a brilliant player, that was a mistake for his second goal last night. Might it have been oh so different if Rashford's shot after 30 seconds had dipped under the crossbar instead of clipping it? Somehow I doubt it. Barca were utterly irresistible. Of course, we built it up like it could be the great comeback. It was too romantic a possibility to have Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, the man who scored that goal in that Champions League final, back at the stadium where it happened, almost exactly 20 years later. It was the perfect fairy tale, but without a fairy tale ending. It would have been a good deal more impressive comeback, I think, than the one in Paris, because this Barcelona side have world-class quality in almost every position. You knew it was bad because one of the things in a five things United must do to beat Barca article I read, number three was keep 10 men on the pitch and hope that Barca don't. I would suggest that if you're hoping that one of the best sides in the world gets someone sent off, you're clutching at straws. I think number five might have been bring a witch doctor to curse Lionel Messi. Incidentally, if there was a curse on Messi, before last night he had not scored in a Champions League quarterfinal since 2013. So there might have been, but there certainly isn't now. 15 minutes in, he nutmegs Fred, leaves him floundering, and then an inch-perfect finish. I could sit here and talk all day about how brilliant Lionel Messi is, but we all know it at this point. You take it as read. There's nothing you can do about it. There was a point in the second half where he had about four United players trying to tackle him and he was almost getting olés from the crowd on his own. It was staggering. But you have to think that if United made, look, they might not have won that game with anyone they could have put out, but if they had a bit more experience, a bit more nous in midfield, the fact that they started 22-year-old Scott McTominay, talented but young, and Premier League flop Fred in midfield, for me, that's a sign of the years of decline that United are trying to recover from, that have gripped Old Trafford, probably since Sir Alex Ferguson left. Don't underestimate how much work, of that rebuilding work that Solskjaer has talked about, of how much he has to do if he wants a clash with Barcelona in, say, 2 or 3 years' time to end any differently. Because, incidentally, if they play Barca next year, it doesn't matter how much progress they make over the summer. They will not beat Barca next year. They might beat Barca in 2 years' time. They might do in three, but this is a long project. This is not something that they can quickly fix. Does that future have Paul Pogba as a part of it? That's my question. We've seen in recent months Arsenal sort of decide to start building a system around Mesut Ozil. I spoke to a couple of people yesterday who are very confident that this is now Arsenal's strategy, that they will look to use Ozil at the centre of that system, that they'll keep him and make the team work for him, essentially. I don't know how you would do that with Paul Pogba at the moment. There was a particular minute and a half last night which summed it all up for me. Right in the first 10 minutes, Barca had been knocking the ball around, as they always do. It was great skill, great class, great accuracy. They were closing in on the United box. They got as far as winning a corner. We know Barca take corners short, so they kept the ball again. They were trying to find an opportunity for a shot on target. United, to be fair to them, defended pretty well on that particular occasion, forced Barca back and were gifted the ball when Arta slipped and gave it to United. To Paul Pogba, their talisman, what can he do with this great opportunity early in the game? Can he inspire United to get that goal, to give them the belief? Takes two touches and shoots from 65 yards. Needless to say, he missed. Barcelona got the ball back and a minute later they'd won a penalty. Now, I know the penalty was eventually chalked off, but the concept is still there. If I were Pogba's teammate, I would be standing there screaming at him. We've just worked our hearts out to get the ball back from one of the best teams at keeping the ball possibly ever, and you have immediately tried to score from 65 yards. What are you doing? I would be absolutely losing my rag at that point. Steven Gerrard, the Rangers manager, stopped defending Alfredo Morelos after his latest red card. He's a great goal scorer, but he just keeps getting sent off through these tempers that he has. I don't know how Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can keep defending Paul Pogba. If someone slaps a £100 million cheque on Ed Woodward's desk this summer, he should take it straight to the bank. Heroes at football clubs, or anywhere, frankly, are those people who perform not just when it's easy, but also when it's hard. Solskjaer was someone, as a player, who was prepared to leave everything out on the pitch, to do what fans expect of their heroes, to play with everything that he had until the final kick and even beyond. He should spend his time as United manager surrounding himself with players who are prepared to do the same.
Love Sport.
It said awful Man United on the back of the Daily Mail last night. Or this morning, sorry. I don't know if that's fair. Let's ask someone who I'm sure will know whether it's fair or not. It's former Manchester United defender Henning Berg, who joins me on the line now. Henning, I know it was a tall order to ask United to go to the Camp Nou and turn over that 1-0 defeat. But were you expecting a little bit more from them?
Well, it's difficult. It's one of the hardest games you will ever play, quarterfinal away to Barcelona, when Barcelona are 1-0 up from the first leg. I don't think awful is the right way to describe it. I think United had to go. They had to risk something. They could have sat back and parked the bus and defended for and hoped that the Barcelona would not score a goal, even though they had the Lionel Messi in their team. So I understand why they tried to do what they did. Unfortunately, they were not good enough. They had the chances to score. They didn't. They conceded the goal and the possession before the goal in a bad way, just very early in the match, where they could have protected the ball better and used the ball in a lot better way. But it have to be perfect if they were to beat Barcelona, because Manchester United at this time is not at the same level as Barcelona, and then you need something special to beat them, and they didn't have that.
Lightning couldn't strike twice as it did in Paris, it seems. Before we come on to United going forward, I do want to ask you about Lionel Messi, because you, of course, played at the highest level in Europe, and I wonder, watching him, whether there is anyone who you've played against who comes even close to someone like him.
No, and I'm very happy that I never played against him. It would not have been a good situation to be in, you know. So it's he's one of those players that can embarrass the best players in the world, you know. So you cannot feel too bad if he dribbles you, because he does that to everybody. I would say the best player I probably played against is Romario, when he played for Brazil. A little bit like can dribble, can do everything with the ball. Similar skills, but of course Messi has done it over so many years, and unbelievable level of consistency and top quality. So it's I'm glad that I didn't play against him, because it would have been some bad YouTube clips to watch later.
Yeah, that's the problem with playing in the modern era, is it doesn't go away. People can watch it over and over again.
Exactly.
United going forward, you know, Ole talked last night about the rebuilding job he's got to do. Do you think they are 2 or 3 years away from being back at the level, you know, with City, Liverpool, Barcelona, Real Madrid?
It's difficult to put a time frame on it, because football can change very, very quickly. You see the results United had under Solskjaer when he took over from Mourinho, and the upturn they've had in terms of confidence, in terms of positivity, in terms of playing forward and getting the best out of their players. So you cannot put a time frame, but what you definitely can say is that they need better players. They have good players today, they have some top players, but they need more consistent winners in the team. And I'm not too sure if they have enough of the right mentality to be consistently challenging at the top. And I think they need some leaders in the group.
Do you think Paul Pogba has that right mentality? Or if someone offers you £100 million this summer, do you let him go?
It's a difficult one, because his potential is there for everybody to see. What he can do at his best is he's the best in the one of the best in the world. He's a World Cup winner with France, where he proved that he's a winner, that he proved that he can be in the system, that he can play a part in a bigger team. He did it at Juventus, so I don't really see why he should not be able to do it at Manchester United, because he's done it at Juventus, he's done it at with France. So it's a possibility, of course. I don't know everything about Paul Pogba, but from what I've seen from the outside, he should be able to do it.
You, of course, know Ole quite well. He's in his early days still as a manager. You know, it feels like he's been there about 3 years, but he has only been there a couple of months now. Were you surprised when he was given the full-time job? And what advice would you offer him at this point as someone who's just starting out and now has to recover from this result?
I was not surprised, given the results they've had when he took over, the change of the team, how they played offensively, a lot quicker football, more direct, quicker, more united football, how they played defensively, defended higher up at times, and also sometimes, of course, deeper. But the results he've had was what gave him the job. There is no doubt about it. And of course, now they not had the same results. And it will be, it's a test for him, it's a test for the club. But that is why he's the manager there. He's got good experience now. He's been at Manchester United for so many years as a player and as a coach. He's been his own man with Molde in many years. As a coach, he's had setbacks with Cardiff. So I think he's got the experience. I think he understands what is needed, what it takes. And of course, he needs to find the right players to come in, find the right balance of the team, the right mentality to make sure that they have good enough players to compete with City and Liverpool. And it's not going to be easy because the squads that those two teams have is, I wouldn't say perfect, but it's close to. The level they play at is unbelievable high. It's the best teams there is in the world at the moment, I think. And in terms of consistency, in terms of quality, in terms of how they are for a whole year round. Okay, maybe Barcelona can have sometimes a higher top level, but in terms of consistency, in terms of winning leagues, in terms of experience and what you need to win the league, I think they are so far ahead. And even if United do everything right in the summer, you know, you wouldn't expect them to beat them next year.
Just finally, Henning, because I know your time is tight, but I just want to ask you, for the rest of the season, United are sixth in the Premier League at the moment. Do you think they will, off the back of this disappointment, be able to pick themselves back up and finish in that crucial top four in the Premier League?
It's a possibility. It's going to be hard, but it's much closer now than it was when Solskjaer took over, because then everybody thought it's not going to be possible. Mm. Now they give themselves a chance. Now Champions League is out of the question. Now the only focus they have now is to the league matches, which can be a help in terms of you can play with your best team every match because you don't have that many matches. Mm. Yes, you have a midweek game against City, but the City match is going to be a great game anyway, so nobody will be tired for that game. So it's they got a chance, but they are competing with some top teams with Chelsea, with Arsenal, with Tottenham. There are so many good teams who are capable of winning their own matches. So it will be tight, but at least United now have the chance to fight for the number four Champions League space. Before Solskjaer came, they were not in the position to do that.
No. Henning, thank you so much for joining us. A real pleasure to speak to someone who's been there and done that in almost every respect. Henning Berg there, former Manchester United and Blackburn defender. He's now managing over in Norway at Stabæk. And, you know, when you look at Manchester United at the moment, I think what they lack are players like Henning Berg. You know, he wasn't necessarily the most glamorous defender in the world, and he also wasn't necessarily a star player, but he was someone who mucked in and who was good enough to perform 7 out of 10 every week. United don't have enough players like that, who know what it's like to win a Premier League, who know what it's like to win a Champions League, and who know what it's like to muck in when it gets difficult.
Love Sports.
Now, I'm joined in the studio by Love Sports' own Guy Watts to talk through the England preliminary Cricket World Cup squad, which came out at 11 o'clock this morning. We've had enough chance to react to it. The top line is that there is no place for Jofra Archer. He is in the 17-man squad to play in the Pakistani ODIs. He's also in the T20 squad to play against Ireland in the ODI, Pakistan in the T20s. He's in every squad except the important one, Guy, isn't he?
Right. He's very much in the not in the one that we, I suppose, would have really sat up and taken notice of. But then again, we can see, I think, exactly why they've done it the way they've done it. To include him in the 15-man preliminary squad, only for him to then either get injured or, even worse, play poorly in the Pakistan games and essentially play himself out of contention would have been an embarrassment that could have been entirely avoided. This way round, he gets a chance to stake a claim in games against Pakistan, whether that's one game or all five, we obviously don't know yet. And then if he does well in those, he gets to come in potentially on a blaze of glory and everyone's going to say, well, how could you not pick him? The worry will be that he has, say, three or four games, maybe even all five. They've got so many kind of question mark players in terms of who gets into the final 11, I think, that it's going to be a struggle to pick five well-balanced teams for those games, trying to win them and also trying to make sure that they get answers to the questions they've got. If he has a couple of good games and a couple of not-so-good ones, that's not much of a body of work, if you like, to use the Justin Rose bit of jargon from last week.
Yeah, the David Brent of golf.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think Jofra Archer is going to turn into the David Brent of cricket just yet. But there's a risk there that he doesn't do that well, and yet they've decided they do want to pick him. They just didn't want to pick him straight away. Interesting interview with Owen Morgan in the Mail today with Lawrence Booth, Wisden editor, who was in these studios just last week. Owen Morgan's line is that they won't shy away from making difficult decisions, or as Lawrence Booth puts it, they won't shy away from leaving someone out for Jofra Archer when it comes to finalising the 15-man World Cup squad.
We've heard a lot from the players this week. Mark Wood, Chris Wokes, basically blokes worried about their place, saying that bringing in Jofra Archer might not be quite right. Now, I know Chris Wokes has been a little bit stitched up, and if you have seen the top line from the Chris Wokes quotes, I recommend you read the whole thing, because he's essentially saying, that's sport, it's kind of how it happens as you get dropped. What do you think the fans think? Do you think they're desperate to bring in Jofra Archer?
The people that would be dropped, if you like, left out, none of them are national heroes, cricketing legends. Not that really we have any these days, if you like. Have we had one since Andrew Flintoff? Probably not. Obviously, Alistair Cook got an incredible reception when he retired last summer, but that was slightly different. I don't think if any of Chris Wokes, Liam Plunkett, David Willey, Mark Wood, any of these guys are left out, while they will have their fans, particularly from their own counties and all that sort of thing, there's not going to be tears shed for them. People aren't going to say it's an outrage that any of those players were left out. If Jofra Archer is perceived to be a better player, English cricket fans want to see us win the World Cup. And barring the slightly awkward, I suppose, slightly uncomfortable situation where Jofra Archer is man of the match in the final in a game where everyone else underperforms and it's only because of him that we win, it would be slightly uncomfortable, I admit that. If he is ultimately part of a squad that contributes to us winning a first ever World Cup, I don't think people are going to be saying, God, it's a real shame about David Willey, you know. They're just not. That's not how sports fans work, and it's not how sports people work. You know, the batsmen who haven't spoken out against his inclusion aren't going to be thinking, cool, that really is rough on X or Y, because they want to be playing with the best players.
And I think that is the point that Chris Wokes is trying to make, that in sport, you pick a squad or a team and it is the best squad or the best team, because that's just how it is. It's the whole point.
He was, and the comment about it being morally not quite right was something where he was almost trying to find a way of suggesting that he did agree or he knew where his colleagues were coming from. I think Chris Wokes' place is safe, personally, safer than either Mark Wood's or David Willey's, because Mark Wood, his USP a little bit has been his pace. And of course, we saw that back to its best in the third test against the West Indies. And I suspect he will still be fine. Liam Plunkett, in my opinion, is the most vulnerable. David Willey lacks in pace, but of course, he is a left arm option, the only left arm seam option. I find it very unlikely that we're going to leave him out of a 15-man World Cup squad. You at least want that option. I think Liam Plunkett, people are saying his pace is a little bit down the last couple of years. It would be harsh. He's been great for us, but he's also 33 years old. He's probably the oldest player in the setup, so sometimes that's what happens. It's ruthless. But you know, Paul Farbrace, who's been the assistant coach for the last 4 years, has done absolutely fantastic work. He's just moved on to a new job at Warwickshire. Sometimes that happens. That's life, that's sport.
Yeah, it is difficult, but equally, what Jofra Archer brings that none of those names you've mentioned is not only the fast bowling and not only the ability to strike a cricket ball, which almost everyone in that team now has, he's also a stupendous fielder. Yeah. The kind of guy who can add 15 runs in the field. You can't underestimate that.
You can't underestimate that. And he's also going to be coming into a side where the fielding standards are extremely high. Make no mistake, you know, when you've got, say, Joss Butler and Johnny Bairstow in a team, you've got one good keeper and one very good fielder. Ben Stokes is arguably the best outfielder in the world. Jason Roy is also extremely good in the backward point region. You throw in Jofra Archer as well. That's a team that is going to give the opposition absolutely nothing in the field. And yeah, you can't overstate that. 10 runs could be all it takes to turn a crucial World Cup game.
You're forgetting that the captain is Owen Morgan, who basically made a name for being a very, very good fielder and then not much else.
Not bad himself either. So there you go. I think it's another string to England's bow that helps tie in nicely with the favourites tag. India, for example, for all their brilliance in other departments, aren't as good as us at fielding. They're better than they were 10 years ago. Miles better, and that's thanks to Virat Kohli by and large. But that is another area where England have an advantage. And as you say, Jofra Archer isn't going to do anything to harm that.
Are there any sort of I mean, we talked about Alex Hales a little bit off air. He's in this preliminary squad for the World Cup, but there's no chance he's going to play, which probably feels a bit harsh on him, doesn't it?
It does feel a bit harsh. But again, that's sport, that's life. And Alex Hales has only himself to blame. He is the biggest loser, actually, as it happens, really, from the whole Ben Stokes incident. We call it the Ben Stokes incident affair, whatever you want to call it, down in Bristol in September 2017. It was Hales, really, who was the one who lost his place permanently in the one England team he was a dead certain. Jason Roy came back in, having been dropped in the Champions Trophy, and has never looked back. He's been absolutely brilliant. He's now one of the very first names on the team sheet, could even be in the test team come this summer. So Hales is first reserve. You know, there's no doubt about that. Anyone in the top four gets injured, Alex Hales comes in. But no, he could have had a place in that World Cup side if he hadn't been stupid enough to get involved in that incident on that fateful night in Bristol. At least he's going to be in the squad. The player who I think will be probably a little bit most upset this morning will be Sam Billings, the Kent captain, who, of course, played a fantastic innings. I think it was the highest ever score in an international 2020 from a number six when he made 87 against the West Indies in a 2020 just a couple of months ago. That was a fantastic innings. I think he probably hoped that was enough to put himself in the frame for that 15-man squad. I think in the end, he's missed out to Joe Denley, who in white ball format, certainly in an England kind of perspective, he, although a top order batsman in red ball cricket, is going to be used as a lower down the order and good leg spin option, because he does actually bowl very useful white ball leg spin. So that can't be overstated. We know how important Rashid and Ali have been to England, and it's good to have some backup.
And Billings's record in ODIs is not that good. He hasn't scored more than 12 in an ODI inning since March 2017. That counts against you, much as he might have not had that many opportunities.
When you know, get them, you got to take them.
And I remember the series against New Zealand about 3 years ago, when Johnny Bairstow came into the side and England chased down like 200 in a rain-adjusted 19 overs or something. And Bairstow had come into the side, I think, for an injury. And it reignited his international career. And it was just one innings. But you have to do that. You get those chances. Dawid Malan basically got into the test team on the back of 170 scored in the T20 internationals. These opportunities are short. In World Cups especially, you need players who can come in and go, one game, I'm going to do it.
You're quite right. Jofra Archer, clearly the first choice for any player who drops out, who bowls at number sort of seven or below. I'd like to think Sam Billings, because I do like him. I think he's a very, very good cricketer. There's a reason he keeps getting picked by IPL franchises, and he's out there at the moment. I think he's first reserve for a top six batting place. But and that's his, again, strength and weakness, you could argue. He can play anywhere in that top six, and maybe hasn't been able to nail down a place quite well enough. At Kent, he often bats four, which I think is where he wants to bat most. But with Owen Morgan and Joe Root in the engine room for England, it's going to be very, very difficult without injuries. So, yeah, he'll be unlucky to miss out. Chris Jordan, by the way, another interesting inclusion in the 17-man squad for the Pakistan games, because he had a fantastic series in the 2020 games against the West Indies. He set a new record for best bowling figures for an England bowler in an international T20, 4 for 6. David Willey then in the next game got 4 for 7, so didn't quite overtake him. But Chris Jordan, it's going to count against him. He hasn't played an ODI, I think, since the back end of 2016. However good he is at death bowling, however much he brings to the field as well, as much as anyone, you could argue, I don't think overall he's going to offer more than any of the other candidates we're talking about, whether it's Jofra Archer, Liam Plunkett, David Willey, Mark Wood. I think he'll miss out.
I think the interesting and key statistic with Chris Jordan is he hasn't taken more than 2 wickets in an individual ODI for 5 years. And that probably says a lot about actually how effective he is as an ODI bowler. Not that effective.
There you go.
And when we're already talking about maybe Jofra Archer taking one place, I don't think we're going to see him lose 2.
Just lastly, before we finish, I think it is worth pointing out, it's fairly obvious we are the number one side in the world. We've been brilliant for 2 or 3 years. This is a phenomenally talented squad. It is a fantastic squad. It's as brilliant an England squad of probably any sport in any format that I can remember us putting together. We've got guys like Alex Hales, who has a fantastic record, who's not even going to be in the team. We've got people like David Willey, maybe Mark Wood or Liam Plunkett, who have done brilliantly in the last couple of years. Again, not going to be in the team. Billings and Archer, not even in the squad. We are extremely blessed with talent at the moment. We're rightly favourites for this World Cup. This team has the ability to do it. Let's hope they can.
I can't wait for us to lose to the Germans in the semis.
Love Sport.
In a perfect world, we would be talking all this week about boxing, because Anthony Joshua had originally booked Wembley Stadium for April 13th. We all hoped it would be Deontay Wilder or Tyson Fury, Dillian White even. But of course, this is heavyweight boxing and politics got in the way. The desperation to maximise profit made out of a boxer before he inevitably gets knocked on his backside and loses all his value overrode the desire to see the great sport and the greats in the sport fight each other over and over again. Instead, Eddie Hearn decided to take his golden goose over the water to the promised land of America to see if he could crack the States. The Beatles did it. Why can't AJ? Sure, great. It's a fairy tale, isn't it? Inevitably, the opponent was not Wilder, Fury, White, or even Luis Ortiz, or someone that we actually wanted to see fight Anthony Joshua. It was Jarrell Miller, a man more remarkable for his size, his nickname, Big Baby, and his record, not his record, of top knocking out top heavyweights. An unusual physique, and more importantly, a big mouth. That was what he was remarkable for. And of course, with that move across the ocean, there was an inevitable cranking up of the trash talk, the animosity that the Yank audience seemed to crave. It would appear that you can't have a fight in America unless you hate each other. I don't believe for one second that all these boxers actually hate each other, but boy, does it help sell tickets and pay-per-views. And that, of course, is what happened with Joshua Miller. Joshua, who I had come to respect for his ability to sit at a press conference and talk thoughtfully, meaningfully, but without aggression or made-up beef, he could just sit there and say, this is what I think of the guy, this is what I'm going to do, and then go out and do it. He talks the talk and he walks the walk. But instead, because he's in America, the boxing itself isn't enough on its own. There had to be some beef. So Joshua and Miller started barking each other at various events they attended. There was the now obligatory shoving match at a media day. And Miller decided to open up on Joshua by claiming there had been doping. I'll tell you the clean version of what he said. This guy, he didn't say guy, has TUE test exemptions for testosterone and all kinds of stuff. He didn't say stuff. I've been doing my research. Who comes out of the Olympics at 220 pounds and goes to 240 pounds in a year? Stop being an idiot. He didn't say idiot. I know bodybuilders who cannot put on 20 pounds of muscle in a year. Fine. In theory, Joshua could have sued him. These allegations have been flying around, you know, a little bit on Twitter and various forums for a while, but never with any credence beyond some bloke in the replies to some Joshua fight announcement on Twitter. You know, it's the kind of thing that happens to athletes who look as impressive as Joshua does all the time, but it's total nonsense, basically. Like that bizarre Bobby Madeley story. Can you imagine? Joshua could have sued him. Can you imagine him walking out to fight him in June? You know, in one hand holding his belts and the other, you know, the judgment from their court case. It would have been laughable, obviously. But he didn't sue him because it's good for the fight. It sells tickets. It sells pay-per-views. It gives it a little bit more. And then imagine the irony, the sheer irony of Miller himself getting an adverse finding back on March 20th. The body VADA have announced that they will investigate the sample, which was returned last month. Both fighters say they're still training for the fight on June the 1st. Now, I'm not going to be Israel Folau and quote some, you know, Bible verse here, but there is something about taking the log out of your own eye before taking the speck out of your brother's that I think Jarrell Miller would do well to read. The substance, incidentally, that there's an adverse finding for is GW1516. It's a well-known substance used to create aerobic ability in the obese and the elderly. It became pretty well-known in the late 2000s. So, look, if that's what he's used and it confirms this sample, it's obviously to gain an advantage and he should be banned. But this is the problem. Let's not pretend this is not a problem boxing has come across before. This is supposed to be the purest of sports. Two men or women in a ring fighting it out for physical supremacy. But it isn't. Those at the very heart of boxing have repeatedly hampered the sport's progress. It may still be kicked out of the Olympics over accusations of corruption at the top of the amateur sport. The best fights between the best fighters very rarely happen because five different governing bodies believe they're all better than one another. And last of all, fighters keep getting drawn into the easy win of doping. Miller's adverse finding has yet to be fully investigated. His camp call it a developing situation and he is still in training. But even if he turns out to be clean, let's not forget that boxing is not a clean sport. And the reason it's not is the way it deals with it when they catch them. Canelo Alvarez used a cock and bull story about contaminated meat, despite the fact that he comes from a family of very wealthy butchers, to mitigate his ban for a known fat stripper, clenbuterol. He was given a 6-month ban. Boxing's attitude to drugs is a disgrace. And the irony is that it cuts its nose off to spite its face. If boxing were a more convincingly clean sport, it would become more acceptable, more popular, and more mainstream, which would in turn create more money, even more money, for all those people involved. But it isn't. because from top to bottom, boxers, promoters, officials, they're blinded by greed. And boxing rots because of it.
Love Sport.
Tactically, did United get it wrong last night? Was there anything they could have done to maybe undo the great Barcelona? Let's ask someone who might have the solutions. It's Alan O'Brien, football writer and tactics truck on the line. Good afternoon, Alan. Do you think that United could have undone Barcelona in any circumstances last night?
Hi, James. Well, it's difficult to think that Manchester United had any realistic chance of overturning the deficit at the Nou Camp. But certainly, I do think it's fair to say that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's starting tactic was a mistake. I don't believe that the diamond he went for was best calibrated to either stymieing Barcelona's strengths or exploiting their weaknesses. I mean, we saw even in the first leg how much space Barcelona's fullbacks were given when United went for the 3-5-2. They had no wingers to track them. And that was the same last night. And ultimately, it was Jordi Alba, the Barcelona left-back, his influence that decided the leg.
I saw some writing beforehand suggesting that if United were to exploit any weaknesses they could do, I think it was what Real Betis did, and try and exploit the wide areas in the Barcelona defence. Did that seem like a valid tactic to you?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there is a lot of space in behind the Barcelona fullbacks. Both Alba and Sergio Roberto, the right-back, advance very high. And there is an opportunity to get in there and exploit those channels, which I suppose is what Solskjaer was thinking with the split strikers last night, Anthony Martial and Marcus Rashford. And you must admit as well that in the first 2 minutes, Manchester United did have a couple of big chances. Rashford was sent in down the inside left channel by Pogba and hit the bar. And then Scott McTominay got in as well in between the two Barcelona centre-backs, only to take a poor touch. So there was some logic to that approach. But ultimately, as I said, the decision to not play with out-and-out wingers, I think, was a mistake in that it didn't fully exploit Barcelona's defensive weakness in the wide areas. And also, in the defensive phase, from a Manchester United perspective, letting those fullbacks advance freely cost them dearly.
I thought it was quite interesting, this split-striker tactic that Solskjaer maybe not has developed, but I don't know how much you've seen of it. It seemed quite new to me to have him play these two strikers, and they sort of sit in between the fullbacks and the centre-halves, so there's no one through the middle. I can't remember seeing it that much that recently, anyway.
No, it's very unusual, yeah, and he's used it quite a bit. He used it against Arsenal in the Cup to good effect. I think you'll recall it was Lukaku who was out on the right on that occasion.
Yeah, and he did it at Stamford Bridge as well, which I remember was pretty effective as well.
That's right, yeah. And what we're doing here, James, is we're painting a picture of the fact that this tactic may be more suitable against bigger teams rather than against smaller teams, which is another, I suppose, feather in Solskjaer's cap in terms of his decision to use it against Barcelona. But as I said, it's just that frailty, you know, that lack of protection for the fullbacks that really cost United. Because, I mean, if you look at the fullbacks they had last night, it was Victor Lindelof, who's a converted centre-back, and Ashley Young at left-back, who is having a disastrous season. And they really needed protection, and it was protection they didn't get.
Do you think there's anyone in that squad of midfielders who might provide that protection? I mean, look, the classic example for laymen like me is N'Golo Kante, who basically provided protection for everyone else on the pitch when Leicester won the league, and similarly with Chelsea. Is there anyone in that United squad who can do that kind of lateral movement?
It doesn't seem so. I mean, they were without Nemanja Matic last night, so they had to play Fred in the deepest midfield role again. And although he did quite well in the first leg against Barcelona, I thought he was a disaster last night. He got dribbled six times. He was dispossessed more often than any other player on the pitch. But, you know, you have to say as well, he has not played there very regularly in his prior career. He wasn't the deepest midfielder very regularly for Shakhtar Donetsk. And the midfielders he has around him, Scott McTominay, is very inexperienced.
Yeah.
For the first goal, you'll recall, it was rather for the second goal, excuse me, David De Gea's error. It was McTominay who got caught in the pocket in behind him. Coutinho was played in by Busquets. McTominay was out of position. And on the other side, you Pogba, who's a disaster defensively. He has no positional responsibility whatsoever. He's the French Steven Gerrard.
I won't hear that, Alan. I'm a Liverpool fan. I can't hear that. I'm sorry. You're right, though. I will hear people criticise Paul Pogba because it's not even that he doesn't seem to have positional sense defensively. It's that he has no positional inclination whatsoever.
Yeah, and to be fair, you're right, because if you look at the World Cup, he was quite disciplined in sitting alongside N'Golo Kante for the French national team along their way to victory. But for whatever reason, when he's in a Manchester United jersey, he just has no intention of regaining his defensive position in a quick manner. And what you saw last night was, obviously, nominally, Lionel Messi started on the right of Barcelona's 4-3-3, but he drifted inside into inside right areas. And because Pogba wasn't there, that meant poor old Phil Jones with his headband, the Terry Butcher throwback, had to come out.
It was the only way in which Phil Jones reminded me of Terry Butcher last night was the headband.
Well, this is true. He had to. I'm sure Terry Butcher hasn't pulled faces like those at any point in the past either.
No, certainly
not. So
you had
Phil Jones coming out to areas he didn't want to be in, and we saw him getting nutmegged as well, if you recall, in the lead-up to Barcelona's only clear-cut chance when Sergio Roberto failed to convert Alba's cross at the back post.
Yeah.
Somehow, exactly. But so that was the problem that Pogba caused. You know, people look at Phil Jones, they make fun of Phil Jones, but the reality is you got to look at the domino effect, and ultimately Paul Pogba forced Jones into areas he wasn't comfortable.
Yeah, well, I could talk all day about Pogba's failings, but I've got to leave you there, Alan. Thank you so much for coming on. That's Alan O'Brien, a football writer from Tactics.
Love sports.
You may, if you're a regular listener to the show, know that my producer likes to humiliate me. It's sort of his whole thing. And one of the best ways of doing that is each day making me predict the scores of the games from the night that's coming up. At weekends, they make me do about 5 of them. It doesn't seem very fair, if you ask me. I'm not Nostradamus. Why don't we review some of the things I came up with last night? Have a listen to my Brighton versus Cardiff prediction. Really tough, I think. You know, these relegation battles, they often are very hard to predict. We saw at the weekend that Brighton can just go to bits. 5-0 defeat to Bournemouth. I think there'll have been some pretty serious words said, unsurprisingly. Chris Hughton, I think, was keen to almost dwell on it, to almost say to his players, look at this, remember this, learn from this. They are much better at home. We've seen that from Brighton, and I think they will probably emerge 2-1 victors. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have got that more wrong. Cardiff really did surprise me there, and Brighton are in freefall. Really bad news for Chris Hughton's men. You know, they are now right on the edge of the relegation zone. Cardiff are in a very momentous run. I would not want to be Chris Hughton right now. They're even talking about sacking him. I wonder, so close to the end of the season, if that's even worth it. What he's done with that squad has been impressive, but is this the end of the road for Brighton and Hove Albion in the Premier League? We shall see. In a slightly more momentous game, I would suggest, Barcelona took on Manchester United last night, and here's what I thought might happen. This game has to have goals in it. United know they have to go and score. Barcelona have all that attacking talent. They rested about 14 players on Saturday and drew 0-0 with Huesca. Neither Suarez nor Messi, their top two scorers, played. So they're going to be fresh as daisies. United, meanwhile, were forced to go all the way to the end against West Ham. I think it will be an open game. I reckon it'll be 2-2. Yeah, I couldn't have got that one much more wrong, if I'm honest, other than predicting a Manchester United win, which, to be fair, I think Patrick Christie did on Drive Time. So I shall take a little bit of comfort from that. Yeah, all right, I did get it wrong. Did I get Juventus versus Ajax right? Difficult again. Ajax really are, you know, the Velvet Revolution. They really are the sort of fashionable team in Europe at the moment, and they are playing some cracking football. They got, of course, that really creditable 1-1 draw in the first leg, but Juve have that all-important away goal. You just wonder how much that's going to play on their minds, give them a little bit of a safety net. I think there will be goals. We saw that in the first leg, that there were plenty of chances. Ajax had loads of them until Cristiano Ronaldo sort of sucker-punched them with that header. I think it's going to be 3-1 Juve. I think this is as far as Ajax go. Yeah, all right. Well, you know what? If you got it right and you correctly predicted Ajax would beat Juventus last night, then give me a ring, 0208 7020 558, because I'm more than happy to hear you, and I'd quite like you to help me predict tonight's games, which is now what Ben's going to try and make me do, starting with Porto versus Liverpool. Interesting to hear Chris Kirkland earlier in the show say that he thought it would probably be a draw, that it's not an easy place to go. Well, I think Liverpool might argue that it is an easy place to go, because there was, of course, that 5-0 result last year. I don't think it'll be that again, but I do think Liverpool are in really great form at the moment. They're playing with a lot more confidence and freedom. Defensively, they're not perfect at the moment, and I know that they're struggling with injury a little bit at the back as well. Nevertheless, I think Liverpool will probably get over the line. I would expect a 2-0 victory for the Reds in northern Portugal. In northern England, meanwhile, Manchester City taking on Tottenham. I mean, you never want to write off Pep Guardiola's side, do you? But I did think that they would win away from home. I thought Guardiola got it so wrong in the first leg. I was staggered by it. We saw him do it before, and it didn't work, but he's done it away from home especially. That's really what he tends to favour, is being a bit more cautious away from home. I think we'll see every cannon he's got out tonight. We'll see De Bruyne, we'll see Sane. I'd be absolutely staggered if he doesn't deploy a much more attacking side. I think it'll be too much for Spurs on the night, but I think they'll go through on away goals. I'm going to go 2-1 Manchester City. Now, my record on this is not very good. I think we've all seen that. But come on, football's a really unpredictable game. It's why we love it. And it's the quarterfinals, which makes it really hard. I kind of want to see a game full of goals at Man City tonight. I think it'll be really interesting to see how Pep copes with the whole thing. Especially after making what was so obviously a mistake. You know, it's very easy to have hindsight, but in the hour between the team announcement and kickoff of the first leg, I think everyone was asking the same questions. Why Mahrez? Why Gundogan and Fernandinho? Why no De Bruyne? And why no Sane? And then why did they only appear in the last couple of minutes of the game? I don't think Pep will have taken that to heart, but I do think he will go back to what made City so successful. We'll be speaking to former City midfielder Jim Whitley next, and he'll tell us whether he thinks he's got it right or wrong.
Love Sport.
David Hayes suggesting that Derek Chisora is interested in taking on Anthony Joshua if Jarrell Miller does indeed get suspended after his positive, or at least adverse, finding from a drugs test back in March. I would suggest that Derek might find himself struggling a little bit with a 5-week turnaround from fight to fight. He's fighting, by the way, Senad Gashi at the weekend as he continues his efforts to prove himself, I think, at the world level. Derek's never quite been there, frankly. He's got some bad defeats on his record, 2 to Dylan White, of course, Ajit Kabayal as well, so whether he would be a worthy opponent, I don't know, but everyone, it seems, is throwing their hat in today, and who can blame them? It's a payday we would all quite fancy. Let's ask someone who really knows what's going on. It's Box Nation pundit Steve Lillis is on the line. Steve, first of all, is this looks like a done and dusted thing that Jarrell Miller will get suspended, does it?
Well, you don't know. You never know with boxing. I've seen occasions where these guys have managed to, and the people around them have used their power to crawl them out of these situations. But it doesn't look good for him, given that it seems that it's quite a dangerous PED he's taken, and one that even there's been medical chiefs have warned against because of long-term effects, including cancer. He's not in a good position, and the odds are he won't have the fight with Joshua. But I will say, nothing would surprise me in boxing if they try to somehow get him through. I mean, I just listened to a ridiculous quote from his promoter, Dmitry Salita, today, just said he's training as if he's boxing on the 1st of June. Well, Dmitry Salita should know better for a start. He's a former boxer. How would he have liked it if he got knocked out by someone who was on juice? You know, really disappointing stuff I'm hearing. Boxing's got a major problem here. And it just seems that promoters are just saying, putting out tweets saying, we'll keep you updated. But no one's saying, what are we going to do to get to the bottom of this cancer? What is a cancer in boxing? And it's a major issue. It's a major, major problem. And as someone who loves boxing, it really annoys me.
Yeah, I'm absolutely right there with you, Steve, because as much as anything else, it makes it hard to, you know, I've got friends who aren't big boxing fans, and it makes it hard to sit down and say, no, it's a really good sport, you should follow it, and then go, well, aren't half of them juicing? is it as simple as, and I know Anthony Bellew will say this as well, is it as simple as just ban them for life, get caught for PEDs, get banned for life, simple as?
Yeah. Well, there is simple as that, but, you know, but, I mean, I've got a tier I'd like to see in place, but there are, we are going to get situations where it's almost like it's not as serious as, obviously, it's almost like, you know, if someone murders someone, they should hang. You know, you could hang the wrong person. That you could get the wrong person done for PEDs at times. So I wouldn't go as extreme as Anthony Bellew there, but, I, you know, I get why he feels so strongly. I know how he'd feel if he got hit by someone who was on PEDs. I would go a two-year ban straight away, not even up for appeal, and then the second time you're caught, get a life ban.
I mean, it was. I think it was brought into very close focus by that Canelo Alvarez ban, where he was only given 6 months, and because he'd already served three of them, he basically didn't have a ban at all. He takes 6 months between fights as it is.
That's right. It's a sport dominated by money, as you know, James. It's a good point you made there when you said about you've got friends who are big boxing fans. I mean, I work in boxing. I love the sport. I care for it. How can I defend it when these things happen?
It's extremely difficult. Let's move on to potential replacements for Jarrell Miller, if we think, as it looks like, he is going to miss the fight instead. Derek Chisora, you might have heard David Haye there saying that he wants to throw his hat into the ring. Hell of a turnaround for a guy who's not exactly known for his physical fitness, but could he do it in theory?
You know what? I've just been talking to someone about Derek Chisora. I mean, also got to take into account, this is about Anthony Joshua looking good in America. So ideally, they'd on the Zone, the app that's throwing money at boxing, who have a big deal with Eddie Hearn. Ideally, they'd like an American opponent. But with Derek Chisora, you've got someone there. We know he's at the tail end of his career. There is only 6 weeks' notice, so you're not going to get King Kong, any sort of real great top heavyweight at such short notice. You look at Derek Chisora, he'd come and give it a go. He'd get knocked out spectacularly, and Joshua would look $1 million. Cynical, yes, but an ideal fight for him. I mean, the other name that keeps popping up is Adam Kalnacki, a Pole who's from Brooklyn, who would fit the bill ideally. But I can't see him taking the chance at 6 weeks' notice. His career's going really well, and his chance will come in time. He doesn't need a fight at 6 weeks' notice. I wouldn't be surprised if it was somebody like Mike Hunter, who's really just a big cruiserweight who Eddie Hearn has signed recently and has had a couple of okay wins over the last year or so. But when it's 6 weeks' notice, whoever they get in, if Miller stays in, they're going to rightly get panned for it. The promoters, the governing bodies and everybody who's involved in the show. And whoever they get in, people are not going to be happy. But we're talking 6 weeks' notice here. And, you know, you will get people, you are only going to get someone who is not going to get another chance at that sort of short notice or is so far down the queue.
I wonder then, does that suggest to you, because I saw Joseph Parker this morning saying that he would quite fancy it, does that suggest to you that he doesn't think he's got any chance of a rematch? Because, well, I quite enjoyed Joshua Parker, but I know I'm in the minority for that, so they're not going to pick him, are they?
You know what, that weren't the worst fight in the world, so I don't think you're in the minority. I mean, just people expect, you know, every time Joshua fights to chin everybody. Look, I mean, you know, Joseph Parker's a long way down. You know, he's got a lot of work to do to climb back to the top, so he's possibly another 2 years away from a world title chance. He would jump at it. You know, also, but, you know, I enjoyed the fight, but Joshua didn't look at his best in that fight. And this fight is about showcasing him in America. And Parker's got that style that won't make him look $1 million.
Yeah, I suppose that's the key, isn't it? You've got to remember, this is not really a fight in the conventional sense. It's a sort of showcase more than anything else, unfortunately. But we'll see who takes over.
Love Sports.
So far, a very positive season, of course. That's why we are here. But we are not here to celebrate our situation. We are actually here to go to the next round. And because the season's not finished.
This is Up Front with James Gray, and that was Jurgen Klopp ahead of tonight's second leg at the Champions League quarterfinals for Liverpool. They look like they're going to make it through to the semi-finals relatively comfortably. Let's ask former Liverpool goalkeeper Chris Kirkland if he thinks it will be all that comfortable. Chris, this will be a walk in the park for Liverpool, won't it?
Afternoon, you okay?
Yeah, doing well.
I expect us to go through, definitely, yeah. I actually think it might be a draw tonight, but we'll go through. It's going to be an extremely tough place. You know, the fans at Porto are magnificent. The atmosphere similar to, well, it won't be similar to Anfield because there's nothing quite like that on European nights, but mm-hmm. they'll make it difficult for us. You know, they're a good, very good team. They caused us problems in the first leg. We got an early goal, obviously, which helped the matter. But yeah, this is by no means an easy game, and by far it's a done conclusion. Yeah, so it's they're going to have to be on the game. But if we play anywhere near our potential, then yeah, I expect us to go through.
Chris, you know the Liverpool fans very well. If they do make it through to the Champions League semi-final, and they have to choose, which is it, Premier League or Champions League title?
Premier League. Yeah, I mean
because it's been so long.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan since I was seven. Used to go to, you know, I went my first game at eight. Speaking as a Liverpool fan now, not as a past player, definitely the league. It's, you know, 30 years now. I think it'll be fitting as well with it being, you know, the 30th anniversary of Hillsborough, you know, just gone. So I think it'll be fitting. And yeah, you know, if you could pick one, then this is the one that, you know, this is the one that you want because it's over a season. Yes, the Champions League is, you play some magnificent teams and you have to be the best to win that, but you know, the Premier League's the toughest league in the world, and if you sit in top come the, you know, the middle of May, then what an achievement, and it's been far too long for Liverpool.
From a personal perspective then, because obviously, you know, you were at Liverpool back in 2005 and part of the club, would you trade that? Would you say, actually, I wish we hadn't won the Champions League and we'd won the Premier League instead?
No, listen, you don't take anything back that you've won. Winning things is hard enough at any level. So, you know, the fact is we've not won the Premier League for so long, but, you know, that's down to a lot of other good teams as well. But, you know, we look as though now we've got a squad that's capable of doing great things. You know, going forward as well, it's been bubbling, it's been building since Jurgen's come in to Liverpool. I mean, what a manager he is, what a man motivator. He looks after his players, you see his passion, you know, he's been adopted by fellow Scousers and Liverpool fans, and if he can get, you know, he's already a legend at the club, he's already adored by many, and if he can just get that Premier League title or the Champions League, then wow, he's, you know, he'll be forever in a hero in Liverpool.
Which way do you think the Premier League will go at this moment in time? Liverpool have got four games left. They obviously basically need City to slip up at some point. Do you see that happening?
I have said this now for many months. I am convinced that Liverpool will win the league. I just feel as though there's a feeling at Anfield. Yes, we've had bits and bobs which games have gone for us in certain moments, and I just think that leads somewhere. You know, that doesn't lead anywhere, and I think it does. I think it's leading us to winning it. Yes, I can see City slipping up. Only, you know, even a draw. They've got an extremely tough game against Spurs coming up, and then Man United after. Now Man United being knocked out of the Champions League, they've got to go and win every game to have a chance of getting in the top four. So I do see them slipping up. I can see us winning our remaining four games, which we're going to need to do. But I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, Liverpool will be rocking for months and months after we win it.
Chris, I also want to ask you mentioned United there with your goalkeeper hat on. David De Gea made a pretty poor mistake last night. I know these things just happen, but there's been a sense that De Gea's started to make one or two more mistakes. Now, I say one or two more, one or two, which is, for a man who's been so consistently brilliant, a surprise. Do you side with that at all?
But listen, these things happen to the best. It's proved that he's been magnificent for Man United. Is he, you know, has his form been as good as it was? No, I think he'd be the first to admit that. But to keep his form up, which he was in, is almost impossible. There's only, you know, one player that does that for me, and that's Lionel Messi. You know, even Ronaldo goes through dips in his form. But listen, he's a top keeper. Yes, he should have saved that last night. He knows that. Will he bounce back? Yeah, absolutely. He's top draw, and Manchester United are very, very lucky to have him.
That's former Liverpool goalkeeper Chris Kirkland. David De Gea, that mistake he did make last night, it was poor, and these things do happen to goalkeepers, and plenty of them you do just have to say, well, it happens, you chalk it up to experience. Ben Foster, for example, you know, we spoke a lot about the mistake he made that cost Watford the game on Monday night, and even after the game he was stood there saying, ah, well, you know, it happens. He's pretty quick, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, and I think that's the sort of thing that goalkeepers all, you know, we speak to a lot of them. Richard Lee, you know, co-host of Drive Time, he will say it himself. You've got to be very psychologically strong, and you've got to be able to laugh off these mistakes.
Love Sport.
Manchester City taking on Tottenham. And I think it's a big night for Pep Guardiola. It's generally accepted that he got it wrong last week at Tottenham Stadium, not just with his knitwear cardigan and snood combination, which I can't condone. He picked both Gundogan and Fernandinho. He left out Sane and De Bruyne. He started Mahrez. He didn't even bring on those two star players until the very last minutes of the game. I would not expect him to make those sorts of errors this time around. In fairness, De Bruyne did look fresher against Crystal Palace, and if he proves the difference again tonight, all will be forgiven. You say Guardiola's a genius. He put exactly the right strength of team out he needed. But nevertheless, you would think Pep will return to what he knows best. The selection last week felt like a man who was overthinking the challenge, perhaps trying to box a little bit too clever. It does happen. Sometimes, and sports psychologists I think will back me up on this, the cognitive thoughts about a game can override those learned behaviours that have been previously really successful. You can do this in everyday life, by the way. You can prove that it happens. If you are tying your shoelaces or tying a tie, you can do it while you're talking to someone, right? You don't even have to think about it. But if I made you talk me through it, or if you tried to talk out loud exactly what you were doing and slowly make every movement involved in tying your shoelaces, you would find it difficult. Just try it at home when you get a chance. Next time you're tying your shoelaces, try and talk yourself out loud through it and do it nice and slowly. You'll realise that it's more difficult. And the reason is, you're using the wrong part of your brain. There are two different parts of the brain for things you've learnt already to do and things that you're having to think about doing. When you use the other one to do something that is known in the other bit, you can't do it. And I kind of think that's what's happening with City. Certainly what I thought was happening last week. They were using the wrong part of their collective brain. That has to change tonight. De Bruyne described Pep this week as even more intense about football than I am. He's so stressed all the time. Sounds lovely, doesn't it? Those stress levels must be at an all-time high as well today, because there's no doubt that these two games against Tottenham are absolutely crucial to how this season ends up. The Champions League and then the Premier League, they are cup finals. Not in the cliched sense that managers often say when they're threatened by relegation, but in a more real sense. I think if they can win these two games, City's belief that they can achieve the as-yet-unachieved, this quadruple, it'll be restored. I think you saw some chinks in the armour last week, just as you did for Liverpool when they drew with Leicester or West Ham, even against Chelsea on Sunday when they came quite close at Anfield. I think Pep's selection will tell you a lot about where his head's at. We'll get that team news at 6:45 in Love Sport Drive. And it'll also tell you where the squad is at collectively. He probably will have to be bold, but don't put it beyond him to second-guess himself a little bit with his selection. Most of all, I think the squad need to rely on their leaders. They need to stand up tonight. John Stones said that Vincent Kompany in the changing room asked them all to trust themselves and trust their teammates, and that will bring the best out of them and perform. On Tottenham's half, all they can try and do is prey on that insecurity. Try and pressure City into mistakes and hope that they come out nervy. If Tottenham can overwhelm them and leave them in a situation where they have to play a little bit out of their comfort zone, maybe, just maybe, Spurs can pull off the most unlikely result and knock City out of the Champions League.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.